We are continuing the series of Kids Church. Yes, the series of Kids Church. So if you belong to the series of Kids Church, you are dismissed right now. You can go back. Well, it's good to have all of you here this morning. So we're continuing on this series, A Call to a Renewed and Deeper Commitment to Christ by Being All In. And so we're doing this series on All In because we live in a world where there are a gazillion ways in which you can be distracted. That, I was just thinking about this as I was driving in this morning. It's funny how this works, but as a pastor, when I talk to people about like attending church on a Sunday, I kind of feel like I'm supposed to have my hat in my hand when I ask them, sort of almost apologetically, like, you know, will you be in church on Sunday? And because I know that what they're going to say or what they feel or think is that, well, there's just so much going on and I have all these other things and I'm so busy and all these other commitments and things like that. And then I thought, isn't it interesting that all of those other things are never embarrassed to ask the same people to be a part of what it is they want to do, whether it's Sunday morning or any other time. Does that make sense to you? So they're not the least bit embarrassed. No one has their hat in their hand, but I'm supposed to. Well, I'm not going to do that. And I'm not going to do that because I think that biblically speaking, that when we can, as we can, Sunday morning is a commitment. And that's just one thing about what it means to be all in. There are many other things about what it means to be all in. And this all in thing is so important because the challenges that face Christendom and the church and the individual believer are so monumental today. There's no way that we can face them effectively unless we determine for ourselves and as a church that we're going to be all in. Because if we're ambivalent, if we're hesitant, there is no way that in the chaotic world in which we live today that you can resist that very long. You will be overwhelmed or absorbed or whatever, which is exactly what is happening. So this all-in thing is a vital theme and very important for us to consider as believers, to be relevant, to be faithful in the world in which we live today. So last week, I began the first part of what it means to be all in by this idea of being called to a theology of place. Called to a theology of place. That to be all in means that God has called you to influence, to affect a certain place. So if you believe, for example, that God has called you to where you live now, would he call you to live where you are now, and not have you be an influence, not be light, not be salt? I mean, it makes logical sense, right? That if you believe that you are now where you are supposed to be in terms of God's plan for your life, then as a part of that plan, how are you called also to be an influencer, a leader, a changer, a light, salt? So that's true of all of us. And the truth of the matter is, whether we do it explicitly or whether we do it implicitly, everybody influences. You can influence somebody by doing nothing, right? You can. Somebody can know that you're a believer and you cannot do what believers should do, and you will influence, you will send a message to people about what it means to be a Christian. And if it means that we don't have to do anything, then we've let them off the hook. So, you know, a theology of place is very important. Why does God have the neighbor living next to you that they live? Why do you work in the place that you work? Why do you have that colleague? Who shares the cubicle next to you? If you've ever like shared a ride to work, why those people and not other people? What are the opportunities that God has given to us by being where we are? And do we have a burden for those people for where we are, where we are? So, I mean, it stands to reason, does it not, that if God has a burden for them and we are his ambassadors and we are located where we are located, it stands to reason that we should equally have a burden as well. Does it not? I mean, it just would make no sense at all if that were not the case. So, this idea of a theology of place is God calls us to be concerned about the world in general. He calls us to ministry through our lives to a particular region. And he calls us to a ministry through our lives in our neighborhoods. And so, if that is true, do we have a burden for any of those people? Do we care? Do we love? Do we hear God speak so that we know how we can influence their lives in a way that advances Christ in his kingdom? Last week, I talked about that great missionary philanthropist and Dr. Livingston, and what he did in Africa, and how he spent over 30 years in Africa, traveling over 21,000 miles, engaging people of all different kinds, sharing the gospel, healing people, educating them, and suffering a significant amount. I was just reading this morning about him, how in one particular encounter, he was attacked by a lion. And while he was there trying to share the gospel, and one of the people who was with him distracted the lion, and then they were attacked, but he injured his arm and lived for the rest of his life with in tremendous pain from that attack. So people saw the commitment. They saw the sacrifice in his life and what he was willing to do. They understood that being from Great Britain, that he could be living a vastly different life as a doctor. But instead, he was there traveling throughout the interior of Africa, sharing the gospel. And so, as I was reading that, I ran across this additional piece of the article which says David Livingston died in that area of Chief Chidnombo's village in Ila near the edge of a swamp in Zambia. On May 1st, 1873, he died from malaria and internal bleeding caused by dysentery. He took his final breaths while kneeling in prayer at his bedside. Britain wanted the body to be given a proper ceremony, but the tribe that he was ministering to would not give his body to them. Finally, they relented. And when they did, they put his body in a casket in a storehouse to be shipped out the next day. And some of his faithful followers broke into that storehouse and they cut out his heart and took his heart and left a note that said, "You can have his body, but his heart belongs in Africa." Livingston's heart was buried under a mulva tree near the spot where he died, now the site of the Livingston Memorial. He was a man who was all in. He was a man who was committed to a place, to a people in that place. So much so that his people refused to give up his heart. Yeah, Bonnie.
How old was he when he died?
I think he was in his late 50s. Very, I'm thinking 50, late 50s is very young. It's getting younger every year, as far as I'm concerned. But so, As a second part then to this, this part of what it means to be committed to a theology of place, there's a wonderful book written by Chuck Swindoll. And by the way, I would recommend Chuck Swindoll. You can get his regular devotionals every day sent to you, emailed. I would consider him to be really one of the most thoughtful, most accessible, most biblically accurate and true writers today. He's pretty old now, but he's just right on point. So there's this book that he wrote back in 1978, Hand Me Another Brick. I remember being at Geneva College as a student when a man named Reed Carpenter, who would have to be one of the most influential Christians in the Pittsburgh area for 30 or 40 years. He was the leader of what was called the Pittsburgh Leadership Foundation, and we were able to get him at Geneva, and really some of us were able to follow him quite a bit. But I remember when we met in one of the banquet rooms at Geneva, and he wanted to do this Bible study, this book study on Hand Me Another Brick by Chuck Swindoll. This is probably the best commentary that I've ever read on the book of Nehemiah. And many of you maybe have never read the book of Nehemiah. You don't like know who Nehemiah is. Well, you're going to know by the time I'm done today who Nehemiah is and what Nehemiah did. But this is a wonderful, in fact, it's just a great devotional commentary. And it's presented as a commentary on leadership, but it really speaks to more than just that. So if you're interested, you can get it on Amazon used, and it's just a great book to read. It's a wonderful book for those of us who particularly are looking for ways to be all in a workplace, in a neighborhood, those kinds of things. I think there's some really helpful stuff in there that is inspiring and instructive. So anyway, the reason why I picked Nehemiah was because of my experience with this book. And so I just want to share a little bit about that with you. So the story of Nehemiah is about a man who rebuilds the wall of Jerusalem. And Nehemiah was a man who felt very much so where he was called to a place. Because what he was called to was a place where he did not live. He was currently living in the country of Persia, in the capital of Persia, which was about 800 miles away from Jerusalem. But Nehemiah was a Jew, and he was a Jew who was a descendant of those Jews that were carried away during the Babylonian captivity. So I'm going to spend some time on the history of this because, number one, most of you don't know who Nehemiah is, and number two, when we talk about that, the history kind of gets confusing for a lot of people. But the context of that history is very important to understanding and appreciating who Nehemiah was, why he's important, and how he's really helpful for us today as believers. So I'm going to begin in the book of Nehemiah with the first chapter, and I'm going to read most of that, and then I'm going to skip over to some other chapters so that we get pretty much what's going on. So if you want to turn to your Bibles to the book of Nehemiah, it comes before the book of Ezra, I believe. So it's right after 1st, 2nd Chronicles. I think Nehemiah is right after that somewhere. A report from Jerusalem. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakalah. Now it happened in the month of Chislev, in the 20th year, that I was in Susa, the citadel, that Hanani, one of my brothers, came with certain men from Judah, and I asked them concerning the Jews who escaped, who had survived the exile, and concerning Jerusalem. Now, there's a history behind this I'm going to get to. But he's asking about these Jews who were already in Jerusalem, and this man had been in Jerusalem, and he was coming back, and he was giving Nehemiah a report. And they said to me, the remnant there in the province who had survived the exile, is in great trouble and shame. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates are destroyed by fire. So if you look on this next slide, that yellow part is probably the extent, the walls that were broken down. Now remember, I don't know if any of you are aware of this, but Jerusalem, before it was destroyed, was an imposing city. It was an imposing city. And so under the Assyrians, and then not the Assyrians, but the Babylonians, all of those walls surrounding that portion of Jerusalem was broken down. Could have been as many as the walls around that red line, but the yellow line is probably what concerned Nehemiah and what he wanted to rebuild. Just so you have an idea of what to picture. As soon as I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days. So Nehemiah has this concern for this place and these people in this place. And when he hears that his people have been humiliated and that they are under great stress and troubled, what is his response? His response is that he wept and mourned for days. I'm trying to think in my own life when I was so concerned about people that I knew who were troubled and distressed that I wept and mourned for days. And I think that it's instructive to see that Nehemiah had great passion and concern for his people. And I think that should say something to us and to me. As soon as I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days, and I continued fasting and praying before the God of heaven. And I said, O Lord, God of heaven, the great and awesome God, who keeps his covenant, who has steadfast love with those who love him and keep his commandments. And so, what's his first response? He's concerned about his people, but then he begins to pray this intercessory prayer. And as a part of that intercessory prayer, what does he pray? He praises God. He acknowledges God as God, that God is all powerful, that he is all loving. So his first response then, as he takes his concern before God, is to give God what is due God in terms of praise and the attributions that he deserves. God of heaven, awesome God, great. You are faithful in keeping the commandment. You have steadfast love. You are faithful to those who keep your commandments. It's who God is. Let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant. And I now pray before you day and night for the people of Israel, your servants, confessing the sins of the people of Israel. We have sinned against you. Even I and my father's house have sinned. So he praises God. He exalts God. And then the next thing that he does is that he says, I am praying for these people who have sinned. And not only have they sinned, but I've sinned. I mean, it's easy, isn't it? I mean, because it's easy to pray for the sin of other people, but then to forget your own sin too, right? You know, because it's, you know, I it's easy for me to do that. Like they have all these problems, but I have none. But Nehemiah is identifying himself with these people as well. So you know what they say about people who sin, right? Most people who don't sin, don't sin because that's who they really are. They don't sin because they've lacked the opportunity to do otherwise. We should be careful how judgmental we can be about other people. Given the same sets of circumstances and situations, we might be worse than they were. Verse 7. We have acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, the statutes, and the rules that you commanded your servant Moses. So he's getting more specific about how they've sinned. Remember the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the peoples. And so he's citing a text from Deuteronomy, which I will cite in a few minutes. Remember the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the peoples. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though your outcasts are in the uttermost parts of heaven, from there I will gather them and bring them to the place that I have chosen to make my name dwell there. And so he's reminding what God's promise was. He's reminding himself, and he's claiming that promise, that if we repent, if we turn to you, even though we've been very corrupt, even though we've rebelled against you, and as a result of that, you scattered us, if we repent, you will bring us back together. And so now he wants these people who belong to God to be back in this land, the promised land that was promised to Israel, and that God would bless them. Verse 10, and they are your servants and your people, whom you have redeemed by your great power and by your strong hand. And so, again, he's claiming this promise. These are your people. And because they are your people, and because of the promises, beginning with Genesis 3:15, because of the promises of how you want to use them to bring about redemption of the world, bring them back. Restore this land. This is all implied here of what Nehemiah is praying for. O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight to fear your name, and give success to your servant today, and grant them mercy in the sight of this man. So he's praying not only about Israel, but now he's praying about himself, because he has a plan, because he wants to do something on behalf of these people in this place. And so we read here in the next clause, where after he says, now give success to your servant today and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. And that man is King Artaxerxes, king of the Persian Empire. And then he goes on to say in the next clause, now I was cupbearer to the king. Now, if you're like me, when you first read that, you think, this is a cupbearer. I mean, how important is that, right? I mean, you have cupbearers and you have chamber pot maids and you have all that kind of stuff. I mean, what's the difference, right? It's a huge difference. So in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had not been sad in his presence. And the king said to me, why is your face sad, seeing you are not sick? This is nothing but sadness of the heart. Then I was very much afraid. So this whole thing was weighing on him, and he's saying, I tried not to be sad in front of the king. Because you know how some people can be that way, right? When they need or want attention, they kind of act all melancholy and sad, and they're long-faced. He said, now, I tried not to be sad, but the king sensed that he was sad. And he said, I took up wine and gave it to the king. Now, I had not been sad in his presence. And the king said to me, why is your face sad, seeing that you are not sick? He could see that something was wrong. This is nothing but sadness of heart. Then I was very much afraid. And he was afraid because any king of any empire at that time was regarded as gods. They could do anything they wanted. If you displeased a king, they could have you banished or killed or tortured. And I'll explain a little bit more about that in a minute. I said to the king, let the king live forever. Why should not my face be sad when the city of the place of my father's graves lies in ruins, its gates have been destroyed by fire? And the king said to me, what are you requesting? So I prayed to the God of heavens, because he was afraid that if he requested something and displeased the king, he could die. And I said to the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, and you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's graves, that I may rebuild it. You're thinking, hey, you're a cupbearer. What gives you the competency to rebuild a city? And the king said to me, with the queen sitting beside him, how long will you be gone, and when will you return? So it pleased the king to send me when I had given him a time. And I said to the king, if it pleases the king, let letters be given to the governors of the province beyond the river, that they may let me pass through until I come. So he has a plan. So he wants to go to Jerusalem, and he wants to rebuild the city. But in order to do that, he needs a pass. He needs all of these governors to let him through. He needs to be untouchable. He's going to travel 800. Yeah, sir.
On the previous slide, is there a significance where they made a point to point out that the queen was sitting next to him?
And I was going to, I'll get to that in a minute. Yeah, so both Artaxerxes and the queen were very popular among the Persians at the time. And they were considered to be not power mad sort of tyrants. And so the fact that she was there and that they were kind of ruling together, it helps to create the picture of just so for example, Esther, which was some years before this, I think it was Artaxerxes' father, might have been Cyrus, had a queen named Vashti. And Vashti was a queen of that, I think it was Cyrus, of King Cyrus. And so, I'm sorry, it was Xerxes. And so she was queen with Xerxes, and Xerxes, who kind of in a drunken mood, wanted Vashti to come out and dance before him and all of his friends, naked. And she refused. So he dumped her and took Esther instead. So that was the kind of way kings could act. And so in this depiction here, I think it's designed to give a sense in which he had a very good relationship with his queen, very respectful, and she was sitting next to him, and they were kind of partnering in some ways in that way. So I think that's the reason why it's there. So it's a good question. So he says, and I said to the king, if it pleases the king, let letters be given to me to the governors of the province beyond the river, that they may let me pass through it until I come to Judah. And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress of the temple, for the wall of the city, and for the house that I shall occupy. And the king granted me what I asked for, and the good hand of my God was upon me. So I'm not going to get into the part where Nehemiah inspects walls and things like that. I may come back to it. Because I want to go on to this next section here that I think is important for us to get to. So here's what I think is important. When Nehemiah gets to Jerusalem, all of the walls have been leveled. And so with all the walls being leveled and all of the Jews that went there before, and now he and the people that he brought, they were unbelievably vulnerable. And so not only were they vulnerable, but to have no walls is to bring shame upon that people who are there occupying that city as well. Great shame. But there's another way that I think it's important to look at this, and it's this, that we see these walls as a biblical metaphor, that the walls that Nehemiah was to rebuild were symbols of strength and affluence. Those same walls define the parameter of what is and what is not as a people. So when you have those walls, you can see clearly who belongs to that city and who does not. And that's important. So it also defines who belongs and who does not belong. If you have enemies that have unfettered access to your city, that can do anything they want to their people, then that's not good. That's not safe. That's not secure. Walls are also designed to keep inhabitants from wandering away. We have fences in our yards to keep our kids in our yards, right? Hedges or whatever. Walls do the same thing. Walls also keep out outside evil forces from destroying those within. And walls are also instruments for peace and for prosperity. So why were these walls destroyed? What happened? And so let me just give you kind of a historical context. We read in Deuteronomy, and this was part of the text that Nehemiah cited in his prayer, where Moses records, if you are not careful to do all the words of this law. So this is when they come into Israel. This is when they receive the law on Mount Sinai. And Moses says to the Israelites after they receive the law, if you are not careful to do all the words of this law that are written in this book, that you may fear this glorious and awesome name, the Lord your God, then the Lord will bring on you and your offspring extraordinary afflictions, afflictions severe and lasting, and sickness grievous and lasting. And then he goes on to say, and as the Lord took delight in doing you good and multiplying to you, so the Lord will take delight in bringing ruin upon you and destroying you, and you shall be plucked off the land that you were entering to take possession of it. And the Lord will scatter you among all peoples from one end of the earth to the other. So both with the Assyrians who destroy the northern kingdom, with the Babylonians who destroy the southern kingdom, Jerusalem and Judah, and with the Persians, when they conquered a group of people, they would take huge sections of people from that land and they would take them and place them someplace else, hundreds and hundreds of miles. Then they would take people from another conquered land and they'd bring them and they'd put them in that land that was there. And that's what happened to Jerusalem under the Babylonians. So because Israel did not keep the covenant, as they were warned hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years before, if you don't, you will be scattered. This is exactly what happened. They were scattered. The northern kingdom by the Assyrians, the southern kingdom by the Babylonians. So Israel had not only abandoned and rebelled against their first love, they exchanged Yahwehism for foreign gods. But I think there's an application for us too. The USA not only has abandoned Christ, they exchanged their Judeo-Christian worldview for the cult of progressivism. So, some of you don't know this about me, but I will tell you this, and I can argue this effectively. That is the most dangerous ideology and worldview since the dawn of time. And we are exchanging our Judeo-Christian worldview for that. The cult of progressivism is all about humanity becoming God. At the end of the day, that's what it's about. So, that's parenthetical. To understand this then, and what was happening with Nehemiah, there were three empires in the history of Israel that related to their destruction, their deportation, their captivity, and the return. The first, as I said before, was the Assyrian Empire. The second was the Babylonian Empire. The third was the Persian Empire. And then after the Israelites returned from Persia and lived there for a long time, the next great empire to conquer them was the Greeks. And after that was the Rome, right? So just so you get a sense of that history. So here it is, real quick. In 722 BC, King Shalmaneser of Assyria conquers Samaria, the northern kingdom, which is today's northern Iraq. In 586, King Nebuchadnezzar II of Babylon conquered Jerusalem, the southern kingdom, and the walls and the temple were utterly and completely destroyed. In 539 BC, Cyrus the Great of Persia conquers and subsumes Babylon and expands that empire. That is today's Iran. Not only just today's Iran, but the Persian Empire went all the way over into Eastern Europe, parts of Greece, places like that. In 538, Zerubbabel, under the Persian Empire, he was a Jew, began the first return. So Team A first made their way back to Jerusalem under in 538. In 479 BC, that's when Queen Esther saves the Jews. Remember Mordecai and Haman and King Xerxes. That's the Persian name, Ahasuerus, but his Greek name is Xerxes. In 464 BC, Artaxerxes, his son, becomes king of Persia. In 457, Ezra returns with a group of captives to Jerusalem to build the temple. And then in 445 BC, with Nehemiah, he returns with some exiles to build the walls of Jerusalem. This is the history here very quickly. So, let me just show you just real quick. I know I'm doing this Bible study thing, but it's fascinating, and I think it's important for you to understand. So in this first map that we see here, we see that's the Assyrian Empire. The yellow is where the Assyrian Empire was located, and the green is the whole of that empire. That was the first. They destroyed the northern kingdom, Samaria, which was the capital. The next map, the next empire, that is the Babylonian Empire. You can see that it's much bigger than the Assyrian Empire. So where the yellow dot is where their capital was. The red dot is where Jerusalem is. When that happened, the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem, breaking down its walls and gates, desecrated Solomon's temple, carried off the Ark of the Covenant, deported and exiled all of the nobility and leaders of Jerusalem at the time. That's when they believe the Ark was carried away, lost forever. Never seen again, under the Babylonian Empire. This is why the Jews regard the Babylonian Empire as just the worst of the worst. The next worst of the worst were what the Romans did to the temple about 500 years later. But they utterly despised the Babylonian because of what happened to the temple and because all of their nobility was carried off. And so in being carried off, they were placed throughout the whole of that empire that you saw. And then they brought other people in to replace the people they took out. Do you know what those people were called? The people who brought in, who replaced the Jews that were carried away? Samaritans. That's where the Samaritans came from. The Samaritans were transplants. People from all over the Babylonian Empire who were put there, and they bred and intermarried with Jews, and they syncretized the Jewish faith with the different faiths that they brought with them into Jerusalem. That's why the Jews despised the Samaritans and why the Samaritans. What's that?
The woman at the well was a Samaritan.
She was a Samaritan. That's right. So they despised the Samaritans. They wouldn't even go on their land. They hated them. And it all goes back to this history right here. Does this make sense? Okay. So we read here where what Nebuchadnezzar did in 2 Chronicles 36, 18 and 19, he brought up against the king of the Babylonians, who killed their young men with the sword in the sanctuary and did not spare young men or young women and elderly or the infirm. God gave them all into the hands of the Nebuchadnezzar because of their disobedience. He carried to Babylon all the articles from the temple of God, both large and small, and all the treasures of the Lord's temple and the treasures of the kings and his officials. They set fire to God's temple. Solomon's temple at one time was regarded one of the ancient wonders of the world. I mean, it would be right up there with the Greek Pantheon, with the Roman Colosseum. But they destroyed it, right? And broke down the wall of Jerusalem. They burned all the palaces and destroyed everything of value there. So now we see the Persian Empire. And the Persians completely overcame the Babylonians. And you can see where Susa is on the far right there where that yellow dot is. And then that's Jerusalem. And that's the whole of the Persian Empire, the largest empire in the history of the world at the time. And Nehemiah was the cupbearer to that king. Just give you a better context, right? So we read then in 539 to 40 BC, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah, the Lord moved the heart of Cyrus, king of Persia. This is the first king of Persia. To make a proclamation throughout his realm and also to put it into writing. This is what King Cyrus, king of Persia, says. The Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has appointed me to build a temple for him at Jerusalem in Judah. And any of his people among you may go up, and may the Lord their God be with them. Totally reversing what the Babylonians did. This was about 80 years, 70 years before Nehemiah. So under the Persian Empire, Zerubbabel returned. Some years later, Ezra returned. Now Nehemiah returns. But before he returns, there are all these exiles who returned, and their plight is terrible. They are not flourishing. And that's why Nehemiah was broken in heart and why he wept and fasted and mourned for days, because he wanted them to be restored. So when we think about King Artaxerxes then, he was considered to be a great king. Extremely kind and a good-hearted ruler. He always appeared to be fair and just. The king could also deal effectively with his enemies and was very just with them as well. One way his kindness was shown was through a decree that he made for the people of Jerusalem. He allowed them to go back to their kingdom and assisted them with their journey by the rebuilding of the temple. So that was about King Artaxerxes. Now, when we talk about Nehemiah, he was a Jew by birth and an exile. He was employed as a slave, as King Artaxerxes' cupbearer. This was about 70 years after the Babylonian captivity. And a cupbearer, he was a person who was a barrier against poisoning the king. So he always ate the food first, always drank the wine first before the king did. Because then, if it was poisoned, the cupbearer died, but long lived the king, right? So that was his job. His job was to interfere with getting poisoned, right? That was his job. All right, so I want to move on then, because I'm running out of time, but I want to get to this application piece here, which I think is very important. Nehemiah was called to restore the land. And as a result, it required him to embrace three different offices. And I want to talk about those offices for just a few minutes. We read about Nehemiah the cupbearer in chapters 1 and 2. Now the cupbearer tasted wine and food before the king to be sure it wasn't poisoned. But as a cupbearer, they often developed a deep relationship with the king. It wasn't like the chambermaid who went in to empty the chamber pot. He was with the king all the time. And they often developed deep friendships. And oftentimes, only the king's wife was more influential because he was always there when they were talking about empire business, family business. He heard it all. If any of you have watched Downton Abbey and you see how the servants are always around and you're always amazed that the family talks as openly as they do while the servants are all around, right? And then the servants go downstairs and they talk in the kitchen about what they heard up in the dining room. And you think, a little more discretion might be helpful. The cupbearer was always there. And so he oftentimes developed a very close relationship with the king. And as a result of that, he could influence the king in ways that nobody else could. I mean, so you might have a military commander come in and talk about his thing. Then you have another state official come in and he talks about his thing, and the cupbearer hears it all. And some cupbearers even made a couple extra dollars on the side because somebody said, I like this promotion. I'm just wondering if you could put a bug in the king's ear, and I'll slip you a fiver if you'd be willing to do that. One Old Testament scholar said that the cupbearer was often chosen for his personal beauty and attractions. And in ancient Oriental courts was always a person of rank and importance. Do you remember that when the Babylonians carried off the Jews, they were the aristocracy? They were the well-educated ones. Nehemiah was a descendant of that. He was a descendant of those people. So from a covenantal nature of his duties and frequent access to the royal presence, he possessed great influence. So as a cupbearer, Nehemiah was called to a land and a community, and as such, necessarily means passionately, prayerfully, respectfully, wisely leveraging his, your reputation, contacts, resources, and assets. Whose trust do you have? And how, in God's providence, is that trust to be used so that you can impact the land that you were called to? Whose trust do you have? A person of influence, a person of means? In what way, as you have gained that trust by whatever you do, might God be calling you to influence the land in which you live, the people that you mourn and care about for? Nehemiah was also a builder. He had to build this wall to restore Jerusalem, to make its inhabitants safe, to raise their honor once again. We are called to be builders. You and I are called to build walls to protect people, walls to define people, theological walls. This is orthodox, this is not. Moral walls. This is right, this is not. Ethical walls. We belong to this kind of ethic. These people do not. This is who we are. But we have to raise those walls, not to be exclusive, but to protect and to treasure what belongs to the Lord. Being called to a land or a community necessarily means facing what's been destroyed. It means honest appraisals. It means being resourceful. It means solving problems. It means not being discouraged. It means networking with others. It means good planning. All of us on some level have to do these kinds of things. But Nehemiah was also eventually a governor. And so he was called to rule. He was called to influence. He was called to bring organization. He was called to establish some kind of law. And as leaders, we are too. On whatever level that is, we are called to influence, to enforce, to ensure. So being called to a land or a community necessarily means taking responsibility, exercising leadership, and embracing a variety of ways to redemptively influence. To make sure that the people that God has given to us remain the people that belong to God. And the people that God calls us to, that we do what we can, we influence in whatever way we can to bring them into a meaningful, saving relationship with Jesus Christ. So I would love for you to think this morning as we prepare for communion, I would love for you to consider how you can be like Nehemiah, how we as a church can be like Nehemiah. Because I'm telling you that God has called this church and everyone in it to a theology of place. This is our community. Those are your neighbors. They belong to you. They fall under your umbrella of influence. And God calls us to make a difference in this kind of in parallel fashion, in the same kind of way that Nehemiah was called, so we are called. Is there anyone who's going to tell me that the walls are not broken down? Is there anyone that's going to tell me that our places of worship, the things that are sacred in our life, have not been burned down and burned with fire? Anybody going to say that to me? That's our job. Let's do that together.